Good afternoon. Everybody ready to go? I'm Galen Cole. I'm a senior scientist with the American Institutes for Research, and we are so grateful for the opportunity that we have to organize this panel and to have a back and forth with our audience, which I guess represents health communicators and public health, and discuss what we think are some of the most challenging and important issues of our time. AIR, American Institutes for Research, is a nonprofit behavioral science organization that's committed to better understanding how to really answer some difficult questions about digital and how it relates to the physical world that we live in. So, the way we're going to conduct this session today, I'm going to give a 10-15 minute talk. I don't know if any of you recognize me from my former career at the Centers for Disease Control. As we like to do in government, we retire and we go to work for somebody else. So I left CDC a little over a year ago. And so I'll kind of set the public health context of what we're going to talk about. And then we'll have a number of presentations, brief presentations, and then I will facilitate a conversation. Our goals are to describe what is effective communication, talk about a process for planning, and simultaneously bringing together digital and physical assets, introduce a model that will frame our discussion and bring some private sector perspectives into our dialogue. As I was observing Dr. Frieden at CDC fight the communication battle around Ebola, it reminded me of everything I learned in public health about the importance of communication. I used to say, and I still do, that communication is the voice of public health. It's the voice that alerts us to new findings, alerts the public to new findings. It helps the public understand how to reduce their risks, how to increase their resilience. It helps us navigate the healthcare system, and above all, it's the voice of cure. As a communication professional, and I have a sideline as a marriage and family therapist, I've done lots of couples therapy for decades, I would argue that communication is one of the most difficult things that humans do. And when I was working at CDC in the early 90s on America Response to AIDS, we were trying to figure out how to do a better job communicating. And we brought in Albert Bandura and Marty Fishbein. And we had a little consensus conference with them and other leading behavioral scientists and asked them what was required to persuade someone. And I was lucky enough to get to understand that there are a lot of independent variables in communication. You don't just say things and expect people to understand what you say, although many times leaders in public health do that. In order for somebody to actually be persuaded, according to these leading behavioral scientists, they've got to get the message. That makes sense. They've got to understand it, believe it. There has to be reinforcement for it. It can't go against their personal standards. Above all, the last point is they need to have self-efficacy. According to Bandura, they have to believe that they can do what you're asking them to do. So because communication is important, because it's difficult, it deserves our best efforts. I'm having a flashback. I worked in the office of the director at CDC in the Office of Communication, and I remember sometimes our best efforts were under duress. So it's not always easy. We need to anticipate how to do a good job in advance, and we need to be strategic, and we need to, if you're going to be strategic and effective, we need to adhere to certain principles and certain best practices. Because those principles and best practices apply to both the physical world and the digital world, I believe, we believe, that in our thinking, in our strategy to be effective, we need to tie those two worlds together as we attempt to be effective. To this end, we've adopted a communication planning process. Many of you have seen models like this. This model is designed to require us to think about both worlds, both digital and physical assets. And again, it's a systematic process. This is important that if you're in this business, that you are systematic and strategic. And I say this because in the early days of social and digital, the IT people were familiar with how to get this stuff up there, and the communication folks weren't that familiar with IT, and so they were working at cross purposes sometimes because they didn't have a conjoint strategy. So one of the points we want to make here today, and I think everybody by now understands that you need to be systematic about all this. An important part that is oftentimes ignored that we're focusing on is after you decide what your KABBs are, what you want people to know, do, and feel after they're exposed to your message, after you decide what the communication mix needs to be to get there, it's important to understand those causal pathways and understand why change occurred or why it did not occur. With that in mind, we started working with the private sector about a year ago and really trying to figure out how they think about getting to that place of understanding. And this is a big issue for people both in the public and private sector. Out of that, among other things, out of those meetings, and this is, I think, our fourth or fifth panel, we came up with something called the precision communication model. And this model makes an assumption that a person is a whole unified thing that is having these confluent online and offline experiences. And once we made that assumption, it really helped us start to move forward. It was very different than the questions we used to ask, like, what's the difference between how a person behaves online and offline? As Kevin and I were having dinner last night, we were pulling out our cell phones and doing things as we were talking, and I'm not sure we were thinking about being online or offline. It's become a part of everything that we do and think, and I think it's important from a researcher's perspective to think that way. Our secret sauce, Kevin will explain a part of it, came out of a partner, User Insight. Kevin is the president, and his work around what he calls behavior DNA, which is an interesting algorithm that comes out of 13 years of research across 22 different businesses. So we were lucky enough to engage with Kevin, and then we added, based on our health initiatives, health variables, and we were able to generate something called health behavior DNA. And this allows us to create personas that can be tracked across this system, as I'll illustrate in just a second. The bottom line is this model, the precision communication model, allows us to track, we call them health behavior personas, in a way that helps us isolate and understand a range of behavioral outcomes. And that's extremely important when you're trying to reach and influence an audience. To just kind of set up the model, and the reason I'm referring to it is because each one of the speakers will refer back to the model so that we can have this at least a loose connection between my introduction and how all of us are communicating around this series of questions. So the model is obviously in the form of an atom. Does anybody know anything about CD synergy? Okay. So it comes out of my work at CDC, where I developed a tool called CD synergy. And I thought it was an interesting way of explaining what's happening as people go through a six-step path It's really cyclical. It's iterative. That represents the fact that behavior is dynamic. It's always evolving. If we don't think of it that way, then we tend to forget to adjust our interventions at appropriate times. And we do something like a one-shot deal and ask ourselves why we're not effective. So with that, awareness, using a smoking cessation example, you might see an article, or somebody might see an article about nicotine replacement therapy. They read a product review or a blog. They try to validate this by going and talking to their pharmacist. Perhaps they saw a coupon. They use the coupon based on this research and the idea that they might get some benefit out of this replacement therapy process or the product. Then they take action. They buy the product. And they talk to friends online and offline. And the little model also gives you some insight into engagement, which is what the private sector is about. I don't know if you're familiar with the engagement funnel, but trying to get people down to conversion, and conversion meaning people buy things. So this would be a low level of engagement. A higher level of engagement would be redeeming the coupon and then commenting online. So the point of the model, again, is it's taking us from awareness all the way to conversion. And if you convert someone, they become this little disseminating unit. They start telling people good things about your product. Or, if they don't like your product, they tell people bad things about the product. What's interesting, and you'll hear a good deal about today, is we're taking this a step further. How many have your Fitbits on today? Or your phones that are tracking things that you're doing? So we're delving further and further into this world where we can be tracked all the time on a number of important variables. As health communication professionals, we need to take advantage of that in ethical ways. So now let's mix it up. Let's see, we've got about 35 minutes. I'm going to let the panelists have a conversation between themselves. I've got some specific questions for about 20 minutes, and then I'll turn the time over to the audience and let you ask questions. So think about your best question. Try to trip the panelists up. I'm sure they would enjoy that. So my first question is, what is the private sector doing to measure behavior as a result of your digital strategies?
Anybody? I'll weigh in on that.
You may have to speak up since we don't have
mics.
You guys
can hear me okay with that? Right. So I think, you know, some of our clients, what they're doing very well to measure behavior change is combining various types of technologies that are available today. One that comes to mind is geolocation services. You know, every time you download an app and you say, yeah, you can follow my location, you're giving somebody some information about where you are. You know, I think about a campaign that Outback did. They call it geoconquesting, which is when somebody goes to a competitive restaurant, and let's say they're using their weather app or a mapping app. They can send ads to them, offering them a coupon at Outback and directions to the closest one. They ran a campaign like that at 80%, let's say 80% more click-through rates than any of their other mobile campaigns, and a 10% jump in redemption. So they're able to see what you're doing, send you a message, give you a coupon, and then do what we call close the loop with the redemption of that coupon in the store. So that's a good way of being able to track actual behavior change. I'll tell you just one more, because this is one of my favorite examples. Google Meatpack Hijack. Meatpack is a company in South America. They're kind of a young, innovative company, and what they do is they sell brands from the United States to younger generations. And they've got an app that their generation, to their customers, have downloaded to kind of follow and show off their shoes to their friends. Well, they wanted to try a new kind of geo-contracting concept, so they came up with a campaign called Hijack. And when one of their, I can't remember what they call it, their customers, but when one of their customers walked into a competitor, they popped this campaign that said, you have 99 seconds to redeem your discount at a meatpack store. And then the discount would pop up, and it started at 99% discount. And every second, it would click off, 98, 97, 96, 95. They literally had people running into these stores all over town. Fascinating concept, kind of a gamification concept, if you will, fun and engaging, but also able to track your movement and then who actually came in and redeemed the coupon. So kind of closing the loop, I think, the commercial sector is doing a better job at using technology to do that.
Go ahead.
You need to be data-centric from day one, right, to be able to understand what is it that you're trying to do. So when we work with customers, like, what is the behavior you want to change? What is the goal? And then how are we going to measure the change that happened? And then, then be able to deliver on that. One of the things, at least I have that in the current healthcare system, the way it's evolving, will be no one comes without outcome, right? So you have to show that outcome to be able to get paid for it. So currently, that's what our focus is. How do we show these changes and tie even our business model around them and be active engaged users around showing drops in blood pressure, showing drops in weight, showing increase in activity type of thing. So I think you need to start aligning your business as a data-centric intrinsic business to be able to then claim and do stuff because your outcome is tied to that.
No income without outcome. I love it. That sounds like it could get fairly aggressive, though. Anybody else have a... Go ahead, Daniel.
Just real quick, just to build on that. A lot of what we see is around attribution modeling, and that's kind of the same deal. But so we want to know if our campaign worked online, if it drove somebody to the site, if somebody got to the site and took an action, especially if that action was giving us the contact information. And that needs to go into a system that's going to be able to slice and dice it. We're big proponents of Salesforce. But then that way that we can look at the whole thing all the way through, and we have systems and applications and methods for handling those leads as they come in because they're very important. And we live in a world that is definitely no income without outcomes, right? So we don't get paid if we don't do our job over here in the private sector. But I think it's equally important for public health and figuring out how you maintain that attribution model and how you know who that person is all the way through your system. Might be through electronic health record, I don't know.
Okay. So here's the second question. How do innovations from the private sector translate into public health or nonprofit sector activities?
One of the things that ME has done really well since their company...
You might have to speak up just a little bit.
One of the things that ME has done since the company was founded is pay attention to the nuances and the qualities of the design, not just that it was communicated, but how. Down to, we use the cognitive theory of multimedia learning when we're thinking and working with animations, how the visual aspect and the auditory aspects come together, down to the prosodic qualities of the voice. So the way that the voiceover sounds and the combination of what's being said and what's being put on the screen. And all of those things from the way that the programs are created in that intentional way down to the interaction design, the visual design of the broader ecosystem of the patient touch points are all very intentionally and deliberately created using design principles, heuristics, to really make sure that we are marrying again, that implies what we know already with what our clients are looking for.
So, Kevin, let me direct that same question to you. How does your user lab How might that help public health do a better job?
Yeah, so I mean, I think one of the things that that we've seen as a trend in the commercial sector is to be more iterative in their approach to design marketing campaigns or products or services. We've come up with a service offering we call Applied Insights that allows somebody to literally design, test, optimize multiple times over the course of as small as a week, as long as a month, with testing the people in person as well as online, using some online technology to iterate testing. So, you know, understanding who you're targeting and what your goals are, back to Dr. Sadiq's comment, is key to then designing the right solution, but it's probably not gonna be right the first time. And so it's really key to kind of optimize that design, but whether you're designing a communication campaign or you're designing an app, you've got to optimize and fix the nuances. And you have to do it quick, right? Because you're trying to get a product to market. But in today's technology, you can do it much quicker and much more efficient than you could even 3 or 4 years ago. And so we use our lab, but also a lot of online technology to be able to do that.
Go ahead, Tom.
So one other thing,
it's very difficult to do, especially as a medical device. When our devices are class 2 or 3 medical devices, is the intervision that phase of continuous integration, right? So we are in continuous building, so this is beyond agile, right? So now that we're doing 2 weeks sprint, figuring it out, ours are daily.
You have to speak up just a little bit.
Right, our flow comes on our daily business, right? So if you think of it, you know, New York Times, for example, they've become a technology company, daily build, Facebook, and all these guys are releasing code in production on a daily basis, and you can test and iterate on these ideas and design on that basis. So how do you move from, let's plan for a year, what we're going to do, how to do it, as you get it out there quickly, test quickly, react quickly, and out quickly. That's what it is. And it's very tough doing it in a regulated medical environment where you're regulated by so many other folks outside and to be able to do that. That's probably our most difficult part, to go figure out how to actually do that on a regular basis. On the staging side of things, we're still limited. We can't do that as fast as I would like to do. But at least on our rest of our platform, we can react much faster.
So thinking of what you said about Higgy, what is the most important innovation that you could use or you could recommend to public health based on what you've learned over the years?
There's so many of things, right? So I think the whole idea of being able to build a model of development and getting it out there in more of an iterative manner is
okay.
The most.
So that's, we're getting agreement across that. Be more iterative, not a one-shot deal.
You'll never get it right the first time. You get it out there, and if it's not working, react immediately. Don't wait till 3 months down the road to change it.
If you start with the expectation that it's not going to be, to remove that expectation, then it's not a part of the equation.
It's okay to fail. Fail quickly.
So building it into the process, this ability to adjust and adapt. Okay.
And today, I mean, you can do that, like when you talk about health communication. You can do that a lot quicker today by using some of the technology, social media technology, YouTube. For example, I've used this example before, Chipotle. Some of you may have seen it, but we were back to the start. And they did this, they created this really cool animation that basically showed how they were going back to the start and raising a very healthy livestock so that the food in their stores was healthy for people. And they started with a simple YouTube video and got some pretty good traffic on it. Got some feedback and they tweaked it a bit, a couple times very quickly, and then put it into some theaters across the, you know, theaters now do these little shorts before the movie starts, so it's kind of a little short. And they sat some of their people in the theaters across the United States and literally had, you know, standing applauses for this video. And so they knew they had something good, and that led them to buy one small commercial, I think it was on the Grammys. And the video went viral. As a result, Chipotle had a 24% increase in year-over-year sales in an industry that would kill for a 3% increase. So they tested, they iterated before they started to spend the big advertising money on the big spot.
Daniel, what you know something about this public health world. You've been hanging out with us. What's an innovation from your world that could help us?
You know, I really think that there's always a big gap at the very end of the process. And in the private sector, you've got coupons and you've got a register that rings. So you can really tell what happened. But working with you guys, it's always like, well, we did this and then it just floated off into the ether and we're not really sure what happened. And, you know, how can you close that loop? That would be the thing that I would suggest, is that how can you create a coupon? Because we always used to, you know, there used to be these PDF downloads that you could take in and get tested for these various things, but there were no codes on the coupons. And at the end, you just handed it to somebody and they threw it in the trash and maybe you did something or maybe you didn't. So I would say that trying to figure out what a coupon means for you guys and how to close the loop on that would be very, very impactful.
If you could figure that out before the end of our panel, that would be great.
Okay,
how can the nonprofit sector stay on top of new innovations? And I think all of you kind of echoed the same thing, that first of all, there needs to be this iterative process, not to create these expectations of those who fund us that you're going to get it right the first time, and then you're saying that we need to have a coupon at the end. Some way of figuring out or incentivizing long-term maintenance of whatever the changes that we're asking for. And we've thought about that for some time. Maybe our audience has some answers there. Okay, wearable devices present many opportunities, as we mentioned, for the health communications field. Speak to additional opportunities that wearable devices might lend to public health.
So I'll take that one real quick. I noticed that we've got an army of watches up here that's really good, but in larger companies, they're starting to incentivize employees to track the data by giving everybody a Fitbit, right? Here you go, we got 10,000 employees, you guys have a Fitbit, and now we're going to do some gamification. So every month we're going to have a new challenge, you know? And I think that works really well for people that are at companies with the wearables, but the big hole, I think, for public health is the problem you're solving. What about everybody else? Because that's where the cost is, and that's where the real problems are, and there's people that can't get access to these kinds of things. So I think that my answer today is going to be, it's the other side of the wearable equation, which is how can we provide stations to give mass exposure to this kind of quantitative self data gathering.
So if you look at the most economic spectrum, this is their telephone, their internet, their email, their TV, all in one, right? So you see much higher penetration of smartphones now in that low socioeconomic demographic than you ever did before, right? So I think Dollar Store was telling us that 75% of the population that comes in have a smartphone now.
Yeah.
So don't assume that those economic can't afford wearables, but they all have smartphones.
Well,
so how does that fit into this play and help you understand what is happening for public health point of view?
And even a couple of years ago, we used to say, oh, well, we're gonna do that with SMS messaging, which was just mind-numbing. But now the numbers are high enough, right, so that you can assume that a lot of people are going to have smartphones.
It's exciting a lot if you know about the government subsidies on these cell carriers and cheaper plans and cheaper phones that are available now. It's accelerating adoption of mobile in the socioeconomic demographic.
When you're talking health data in a public health context, these tracking devices, there's concerns about privacy. What are your thoughts around that?
I think that's the two things we needed from day one. The one was we be data centric, and the two was we worry about privacy first before we do anything else. Right? So we do a lot of interesting things from that point. I mean, all the data in the AE is in a public cloud, in Microsoft Azure, right? We don't have a paid environment, lock and key, call in Microsoft Azure Cloud. But what we did was on day one, the one was we never store a password. So like, what do you mean you don't store packets? So we do a multi-hash, multi-faulting, the technical term to basically load the password as 256 characters multiple times so that it doesn't say a password at the end, right? So, and then we apply something called bcrypt. Bcrypt is the time factor to password decryption. So what it does is, instead of, it takes 50 milliseconds to decrypt the password. And if you do an incorrect error, it doubles the decryption time next time. So tomorrow, somebody comes with a quantum computer that can do 100 times faster compute, the time to decompute is 250 milliseconds, it doesn't change. So you kind of have to think through from a technology point of view how you're going to protect the user, right? Our philosophy is if users say that they own it. We are custodians of it and we don't do anything without their permission. So how do you deal with making sure the user understands what is the data being used for, how much control they have, and how do you secure it? Even when we store the data, a few things we do interestingly is every user has their own encryption key. So we don't encrypt the entire database, we encrypt per user. So whatever reason there is a compromise, there's only single users getting compromised, not everything else. Next thing we do is we separate out the PHI, the identifier information about you, and the health data in two separate stores. And then there's no linking between the two databases. The link of the two and the encryption key is stored in Amazon. Completely separate data center. So even if there's a breach happen in Microsoft Azure, you have no way of knowing that this data belongs to Galen or, you know, Ryan or whoever. It has to be social engineering type of where they only able to find somebody in our company, only two people as we can do it. And I would somehow have to convince us to be able to give them keys to that stuff. Otherwise, it made it very, very, very hard to do that. Nothing in ET happens without user opt-in. So no data share happens with anybody without user explicitly agreeing to an opt-in policy. Right? So you have to have the culture of privacy or the culture of data-driven metrics in the company. And it needs to be part of the DNA to be able to then do all these things in a much scalable manner.
Daniel?
I think what he's saying is that he's going to license his security environment to the public sector so that it'll work. Because otherwise, my comment would be is privacy is an illusion. It doesn't really exist. And then I'll throw it over to Kevin for what he usually says, is that you're willing to give away your information if it makes something easier for you. So if you're thinking about it, you're willing to give away your quantified self data if it makes something better, like your health. So.
And that's true. We did a large study for McAfee here in the United States looking at internet security and online privacy and the public's attitude toward that. That was the slide I didn't get to show you in my original talk, but I'll rail off a couple of examples to Daniel's point. The end result of that was a large quantitative study that we did independent of one that McAfee did in with their own customer database, and we found the result to be exactly the same, which was that no surprise here, 60% of the population is worried about their privacy and their online data, which by the way, also means that 40% are not. So start there. But of the 60% that were worried about it, a full 50% of half of those people said, however, if I give you this data in return for a customized or more meaningful experience to me, I'm willing to do that. So two-thirds of the population don't mind giving up that data as long as what they're getting back is of value to them. And I think that's the key. We have to create outputs that are of value to people.
I think one of the things that we struggle with is re-identification of data, right? So outside our systems. So for example, somebody goes and checks on Facebook that I just had on the radio station, and then you have de-identified data available for that to somebody, can somebody then go and look it up and say, oh, this was Mr. Jones? That's, you know, so we struggle with all that stuff. So one of the things we do in a company is fun sprints. So I give the dev team, a technical team, 2 weeks to do whatever they want to do. And the last one, team decide to hack our own system and figure out how we're going to break in and identify somebody else. That led to understanding that we have now randomized in the identification process, also randomize the time of when you're checking in so that there's no way to connect social media data from third-party sources and figure out whose data this is. So we constantly do hit ourselves and try to break our system.
Great. Okay, audience, give us a question. Yes.
may not have smart glasses. Or if they do, and the app is free to them, they have to have a credit card on placed on to the Play Store so that they can download the app. They don't have a credit card. Now, we, as a federally qualified health center, we need no money, okay, are paying a lot of money for this technology. And how is that fair? I mean, I have two concerns. One is the digital divide for patients, because we already see it with people who have computers, people who don't. People have access, people don't. And so we've been very surprised, and even people who have downloaded the app, then we have to rely on who's talking to them over the app, and our staff doesn't have that time. So I'm concerned about that kind of a digital divide, the have and the have not, who can have support this technology. And then who's carrying the cost? Because we're not profit. You're not. And so where's that sort of healthcare industrial complex? That one side is scrambling for money and the other is supposed to be profit. I'm sorry, my daughter is a stock analyst. She covers biotech and asked to go venture capital in biotech, and she would kill me to give a thing. But, you know, she and I had this argument at the billion months. So I just thought I would ask.
So is the question how to make things fair?
How do we make that work?
Yeah. So do you have any solutions that, yes?
I don't know which region in the country you're in. We work with a lot of SUACs, so we can talk afterwards and
sure.
What we've done so far. It's all about finding the right influencer, right? So when we go in with a provider and partner, whoever it is, we can't name one because of kind of customer, we're not permission to do that. But what we do is identify to find what is it. Maybe generalize and talk about it, right? So I'll give a hypothetical example. I mean, there's no customer right now doing this. So Dallas, Texas. You think about it, you know, divided into four quarters. The southeast quarter is the low socioeconomic demographic, have one grocery store. The rest of the environment has 355 grocery stores. Right? So that's where the problem is. No, and that's where the FQHCs are located. There's no way. So we were, you know, what you could do is you could work with providers and payers in the area trying to address the community and then get them to fund this whole idea of having like a station inside there where they don't have to own stuff, they still can use some of our devices. So we're doing that not in Dallas, some other places. We'll be partnering with healthcare providers or payers or even retailers to put this, because they want to get the message out to those folks in that in those communities to be able to engage with them at a different level, either in a healthcare point of view or in a retail point of view. So there are a lot of different avenues to approach that.
So there's at any, we don't have a native app. Everything is delivered is web-based. And we've done that very purposely for that very reason, because we want to take out absolutely any obstacle that might stand in the way of someone getting content, like downloading an app. The other thing that I'll just add there that we use as a really effective intervention is interactive voice response phone call, especially in that type of population. What they do have is a phone, right? They can answer the phone and they can talk back to the system, and we have that in a heart failure transition program. 45 days, they get a call a day. They log their weight, whether that they've gotten their medicine refilled, then to their follow-up appointment. If they have any emotional issues, and all that information gets sent back to the physician. So there are lower cost ways that are very effective as well.
Information lives on your end, it's not the patient's record. So if somebody's putting their weight every day and putting your name to your, we don't have that information in our record.
In terms of the contact information?
Yeah, I mean, like we have patients who are doing their blood pressure every day and entering it into the app. That's not in the patient's record that we access. We can access the application, the app that they've downloaded.
That's another option.
Sounds like you need a new app. Great. Any other questions? Yes.
Can you talk
education or external incentives? Like, what keeps people coming back?
Right.
So for context, so for us, it's context. And the relevancy around things. So we have a pretty equal distribution of start rates. So when someone gets an invitation in their email to do the program, when they get a call to do the program, it's pretty well distributed across age, demographics, and geography. So even things like getting a colonoscopy, you know, might just be you might have an ACO that's going to send 100,000, you know, emails because they want everybody to get, you know, colonoscopy mammogram, whatever it might be. Even those, I think, is around context and having it resonate around something, again, not just the treatment or the condition, but something other than just health is kind of what I mean by context. So whatever, you know, resonates beyond just the immediacy. So we're testing a few different interventions for an interactive voice response phone call and trying to get what types of psycholinguistic, so the narrative and the words around outreach around flu this year. Another one is maybe doing a wellness eval over the phone. So what types of narratives are more compelling for people to stay on the phone, for example, and complete a questionnaire, or what type of narrative we're comparing things, why someone would want to get a flu shot. It's going to harm others, it's going to harm themselves, last year's was bad, you know, what types of things, so we can, again, kind of a fancy intervention thing, kind of testing those things to see what resonates with their context.
Okay, I'm going to move to the next question. There was one back here, go ahead.
So one of the things we initially focused on was no self-reported data, mm-hmm. and number two was have to repeatable measures that we can measure during the
okay.
So we kind of intentionally had stayed away because that's a very hard problem to get to. Right? Mm-hmm. So
right.
having done that in Microsoft, trying to understand that stuff, I wanted to release that. It's in our roadmap, we'll figure it out one day. Mm-hmm. But right now we're focusing on machine-generated data, don't ask people any questions. In our platform, it all has to come to other centers of other device, and it's all about things that you have to do on a regular basis. So because we are focusing on habit formation, not focusing about what is your one-time, you know, status of it. Right? So I call myself anti-HRA because they, in Microsoft, I learned in HealthWall, if I wanted somebody to cancel the HealthWall account, I had to do HRA. Right? So it was designed for insurance industry, not for consumers to be motivation. So whenever I could go into these questionnaires, there is a way to do it. You know, there's great ways to ask these questions and to be part of it, but if I can figure out what the right way to continuously engage with somebody in a mental health behavior model and get the data in a more effective manner, I would absolutely consider it. I just haven't figured it out.
Next question. Yes.
That's a tough one to convince to do, but I think at the end of the day, data shows. So, you know, if you can figure out a project where you can actually implement something truly quickly and get results back, you will be able to convince people. That's how we've done in the past. We have a lot of folks who are very traditional waterfall development approach. So when you work with a partner, they have to have a year-long planning cycle before they do anything else. And we come in to do something and solve disruption or happening. So, you know, then we start working with them with anxiety for the first 2 weeks, then they start getting comfortable in a month, and by 6 months they're like, wait, this is, like, how do we do this in our environment too? So I think it's a learning process. Just,
I also think it's not all or nothing, right? Because we need those randomized control trials as well. We have lots of data, but we also want that, you know, randomized control cells. So we want to iterate, and then do it through. So I think maybe the narrative around that, not just all iterating in, you know, little things, but kind of.
I second that. Don't get me wrong when I say, you know, everything you need for this. So I'm currently doing a randomized control trial, which is a long-term trial, but you have to get the state to find, now we've done it, we know, but now we have to prove it. Is it just correlation or causation? Right? But that's when you have to get to RPTs and figure out what exactly is happening.
Thank you so much for coming. Daniel and I have to catch a plane. Our contact information is in the APHA manual or whatever it is. Thank you so much for coming, for your questions.